Today is Friday, September 12th, 2020. This is our Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. This is a part two interview. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Kurt. How are you today?
Afternoon, Tom. I'm doing very well.
Good. Kurt, may we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Sure.
Thank you. You know, we ended up part one. I was curious because it sounded like you were having such a good time at Cottonwood, and you had, you know, had to run away from university in the spring to start that seasonal job, and here it is, the summer's ending and the next college semester starting. Did you quit the job then at Cottonwood to get back to school? How did that all work out?
No, I finished my job at Cottonwood, which I believe was in September, April, May, June, July, August, September, late September. So college had already started. And I think I mentioned in the last interview that the director, the regional director, had come by Phantom Ranch and arrived on a motorboat, and Tom Doerr. My recollection is that Tom Doerr was the boatman. And when I finished working, I had the opportunity to volunteer in Parks program, and was able to go on my first of many river trips, not many compared to the boatmen by any means, and boat women, that so I finished, I don't know for sure what part of September it was, and joined Tom and a couple other people on a 1 week patrol trip through the Grand Canyon on J-Rig. I think one of the other people was Ray, a ranger from Indian Gardens. It was also a seasonal and terminated about the same time I did.
Do you remember Ray's last name?
I don't remember Ray's last name.
And how do you spell Tom's last name?
D-O-E-R-R.
D-O-E-R-R, thank you. What do you remember that river trip?
Pardon?
What do you remember that river trip?
Well, it was one of the finest recreational trips I've ever taken, and it exposed me to the entire reach of the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River, which is absolutely stunning. So what I remember most about it were these J-rigs, the outside pontoons sort of sloped up in the front, and there were straps on them, so you could ride the rapids by pretending you were riding a Boston Bronco. Hold on. I was on one of the front pontoons, or the front of the pontoon, when we went through Horn Rapid, just down below Phantom Ranch.
Horn Creek.
Yeah. And there's lots of water, and I'm holding on, and we get through the rapid, and I'm sort of getting closer and closer to the river level. And we had hit a rock and punctured the pontoon. And so I turn around and look at Tom, and he's just laughing. Well, how'd you like that ride? So we motored over to the first beach and proceeded to repair the pontoon and then finished the trip. But I think that was the trip that caused me to fall in love with the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
So, yeah, you can hike it or you can take a boat. And the boat provides you with access to so many different side canyons that are just incredible. And turned out in my career that I was able to be on the river many times in many different weather conditions. And it's just an amazing place. Ribbon Falls was amazing to me, and that was average compared to some of the other places that we were able to see.
Wow.
So then I got in my car.
So hang on a second, but I want to kind of hang on this trip for just a minute. This is mid-September-ish?
That's my recollection, yeah.
Did you see anybody else down there?
No, there were very few people down there then.
Okay.
A few other concession operations. I don't recall any private trips at the time.
Okay.
It could have been, but I don't recall.
Were you guys doing any cleanup of campsites or anything like that when you were there?
Yeah, that was standard procedure on all river patrols.
Okay.
You go into the different beaches that are utilized by the private and commercial operations. And, for the most part, they're pretty clean.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, we did some patrol trips that were... We took a trail crew with us, and we worked on side canyon trails that were more readily accessible from the river than from either of the rims.
Had that so that hadn't started yet, the trail crew working on the river?
In 1972, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Anything else about that trip you can remember except punching a hole in the boat there at Hunt Creek?
Again, 22-year-old kid exposed to one of the greatest parks in our system.
Hmm.
Pretty phenomenal.
Did you guys go all the way out to the lake, or were you taken out at Diamond Creek? Do you remember?
I think we took out at Diamond Creek.
Okay.
Rather than going to Pierce Ferry.
Do you know why that was?
No.
Okay.
Because that's where Tom said we were taking out.
Okay. Simple enough. And that boat, I'm assuming you had to take it all apart, tube after tube after, kind of untie it one from the other. And then roll it all up and put it all in some big steak truck?
Mm-hmm.
And then hump some big giant aluminum frame up on the truck as well?
Yeah, and a couple of motors.
And a couple of motors, okay. All right.
Didn't take all that long.
Okay. And then what are you going to do? I mean, you don't have any school to go back to. You've had this amazing river trip. Then what happened?
Well, so I drove back up to Colorado, saw the folks in Aurora, and I had made some friends in college, and I had also... I think in the last interview I forgot to mention that I had also gotten a job as a surveyor's assistant with the Forest Service out of Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Yeah.
And another fellow there, whose name I'm trying to recall right now, Tom, he'll come to me. So I went back up to Fort Collins. And started school in January.
Okay.
And about that time, seven out of six of us decided that we didn't want to pay rent. So we bought 9 acres of land up in Rist Canyon.
Where's that?
It's north and west of Fort Collins, up in the foothills.
All right.
There's been a couple of different fires up there since then, Rist Canyon fire and now the Cameron fire this year. But we were six and eventually seven folks that decided we... One of the guys was a Volkswagen mechanic. Several of us were college students. And this was 72, 73, 74. So we decided we'd build a log cabin, and until we got the cabin built, three of us were living in teepees, and a couple other folks were living in, actually four of us were living in teepees, and a couple other were living in camper trailers. And the place was called Tokahe, T-O-K-A-H-E, and we built a log cabin. We put a log cabin together that had been pre-assembled. I think it came from Montana.
Okay.
Came on a semi-truck, and every log's end had a numbering system. So we basically built a Lincoln log cabin and roofed it and planted a garden and had a bunch of parties.
All this while you were going to school that spring?
Yeah.
Okay.
And most of us had Volkswagen boats. So we had a little competition to see who could get down the hill, how far you could get downhill from our land without turning your motor on. So, went to school. Used the university's gymnasium, played a bunch of racquetball and handball, and used the steam room and showers to clean up because there was no running water where we lived. And we heated with wood, cooked with wood. We had an outdoor kitchen, even in the winter. So one of the things I remember about that time was people would kind of look at me like, you smell wood smoke. You know, I live up in the hills. I thought it was pretty cool. Most of them probably thought it was pretty weird.
It sounds very communal living, sort of the...
Yeah, we were accused of having a hippie commune.
Okay. How long was your hair?
That was down to my shoulders.
Okay.
After a couple of years. In fact, that's another funny story. So, that's what I did, and then I went back to school, lived in a teepee, built a log cabin, thought I was living a good life. And I think in 1974, I'm not sure what happened in 1973, it might have been 73. Ended up getting a job at Rocky Mountain National Park, courtesy of Larry Van Slyke.
Did you then go to school in the fall of 70? Let's see. All right, so it wouldn't have been the fall of 72 because that didn't work out. Back to school in the spring of 73. So the fall of 73. Were you still in school then?
I think in the fall of 73. I was living in Fort Collins. I think I was going to school. Graduated, finally ended up graduating in December of 74. It was a time of going to school and having odd jobs and whatnot in some place in there. Probably the spring of 73, I moved my teepee down to the farm where Tom, we had met when I was surveying, Nygren, Tom Nygren, and his dad, Bill Nygren.
How do you spell his last name?
N-Y-G-R-E-N. He ended up going to work, he was an engineer, and he ended up going to work for Coors.
Okay.
But I don't know if it was the spring of 73 or spring of 74, someplace in there. His dad needed some help on the farm, so I dropped out of school and moved my teepee down to the farm and learned what the farmer's life was about.
Okay.
So, worked on the farm. And then, I don't know, 73, 74, ended up going to work in Wild Basin at Rocky Mountain National Park.
Okay, so in the meantime, let's catch up with Larry a little bit. He kind of got you the job there at Grand Canyon, but he didn't quit school. He kept at it. Had he already graduated then by December 74?
Yeah, I think he graduated in 72.
Okay.
72, someplace in there. And ended up getting a permanent job at Rocky Mountain.
Ah.
As a park ranger, not a park technician.
Okay.
And when you talk to him, you can ask him if that's correct. he and I were seeing each other occasionally. He was living in Fort Collins. I was living up this canyon. And
so did he offer you a seasonal position at Romo? How did that work out?
Yep, seasonal position. I think I started in June, ended on the 89th day, because if you were hired for more than 90 days, Park Service had to pay you vacation pay. And so seasonals at that time were known as the 90-day wonders. Because you ended up working the 89 days, so the Park Service didn't have to pay you vacation time.
Interesting.
That's how short the Park Service was on money.
Wow.
Still is.
Yes, still is.
So, went to Rocky Mountain, and George Wagner was the district ranger at the time.
I'm sorry, how do you spell George's last name?
W-A-G-N-E-R.
Okay.
And George was a throwback to the old-time rangers. And interestingly, later in my career in 1983, I ended up in Skehekin, at the North Cascades complex, North Cascades National Park. Has North Cascades National Park, and then it has Ross Lake and Skehekin National Recreation Areas.
Okay.
And I didn't know it at the time, but George had been a ranger at Skehekin before he came to Rocky Mountain. So I ran into George's reputation when I ended up getting to Skehekin. Anyway, George was the district ranger, and Larry was the East District Ranger, and Larry was the backcountry sub-district ranger.
Okay, so Larry got to climb Long's Peak and do some fun mountain stuff. George, as the East District Ranger, so some forest country. I'm trying to place that land. Is it Nederland? That's the name. What's the name of the town there?
The name of the town where?
East side of Rocky Mountain National Park on the Denver side.
Estes Park.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So George was a district ranger. He had a couple of sub districts. front country sub-district, back country sub-district, I think. And Larry was the back country sub-district ranger. And about 16 of us worked for Larry as the back country rangers.
Wow.
They were known as the Rocky Mountain Boys. As opposed to the Yosemite Mafia.
Okay.
A little competition between the rangers at Rocky and Yosemite, which was all unjust, but
mm-hmm.
which we always had to do better. We had to climb more routes. We had to rescue more people. Of course, Yosemite had the advantage because they had a lot more climbers. Anyway, worked in Wild Basin, so we could correlate that. So I worked in Wild Basin the first year.
Where's that in relation to the summit of Long's Peak?
It's south of it.
Okay.
Wild Basin was the most southeast ranger station in Rocky Mountain National Park.
Okay. Now, is there a route up Long's Peak from Wild Basin? Can you come up Long's Peak on that southeast side?
You couldn't at that time. Or, let me say, nobody did it that I know of.
Okay.
But, you know, it's sure it could be done. But at the time, if you wanted to go to Long's Peak, you went back out to the main road, went north, and took the Long's Peak cutoff.
And in this is 74, had I think it's, help me out here, is it called the east face of Long's Peak? It's this, like, amazing climb of incredible granite that people like Leighton Core were out there climbing on?
Mm-hmm. That's the east face.
Okay.
The diamond.
The diamond, thank you.
In the last interview, I told you the first time I went up with Larry, I think I might have said I went up the east face. I didn't go up the east face. I went up the north face.
Okay.
Which is a very simple route with a cable.
Yeah.
If I said the east face, I'd have been telling the stories. Larry and Charlie Logan summited the east face, I think, a couple different times, maybe just once. Well beyond my climbing skills.
It was. Okay, I was going to say, did you ever climb that?
No. I think one of the reasons that Larry hired me was one of the times I was visiting him at Long's Peak, and I went out on my own hike and went up to, I think it's called Chasm View, that's the east face. It's just on the south side of it. That's the east. Or just on the north side of the east face, you can actually drape your legs over the drop-off and watch people climb, which is what I was doing very ignorantly. Safety-wise, that's a stupid move. And I heard people shouting for help, and a climber had fallen. And so I took off and ran back to the ranger station. I don't know what that was, 4.5 miles, something like that. And reported in to Larry, and they assembled a rescue crew, and I volunteered to help carry supplies and equipment. And I think at that time Larry decided that, yeah, we're going to hire you.
He's tough enough.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing. So I worked in Wild Basin and was on the search and rescue team. At that point in time, rangers were wildland firefighters. And so we fought fire. We did daily patrols. Did trail work. And responded to rescues.
It must have been a beautiful a beautiful time of year going through June, July, August. I mean, the aspens would have been changing at the end of your 90 days.
And the elk were bugling.
Wow.
So I think that was my first year at Rocky.
I'm going to back off a minute here and were you folks, I mean, they must have been happy that you graduated. Were they kind of settling into the fact that you were, you know, becoming a park ranger?
Yeah, I think they were.
Nice.
Still a seasonal job. I think they were settling into it. I think Dad was quite happy because of his love of the outdoors, being a bush pilot and all.
Nice.
Actually, you know, now I think about it, that must have been 1973. In 74, Larry moved me to Fern Lake Patrol Cabin up in the center part of the eastern half of the park, center park. Yeah. I think that was it. So,
what was the difference between Wild Basin and Fern Lake?
Well, Wild Basin you could drive to and park and you go hiking. Fern Lake was go in through Moraine Park to the trailhead, and then you hiked in about 4 miles to the Fern Lake Patrol Cabin. And actually, there used to be a Fern Lake Lodge there. In the early 60s. And I can't quite recall, but I don't know if it was Judy Collins, Joni Mitchell, one of those two, parents ran the Fern Lake Lodge.
Oh, wow.
And who was that other gal? Somebody else of that era, another female performer. Her parents ran Paradise Lodge. Big Paradise put up the parking lot.
Yeah.
Anyway, Fern Lake Lodge burned down years before I got there. And so I'd hike into Fern Lake and had a quaint little log cabin. Log cabins seem to be a trend here.
They do.
and you just patrolled. And we had a campground there and same old stuff. Checked on campers, made sure they were okay, made sure they had a permit, made sure they had a fishing license. And
so, Kurt, I'm curious, at Cottonwood, of course, it's a lot more than 4 miles from anywhere. You had mules to get your 10 days' worth of supplies in there. At Fern, did you have any livestock or pack stock to help you get your gear in there for the tour of duty you were on?
My recollection is in 1974, we did not have any pack stock.
Okay.
But sometime in that 74 through 76 era, a superintendent by the name of Roger Contor, C-O-N-T-O-R, I think, decided that he was going to introduce horses to the backcountry program. And he brought a fellow in, 74, 75, someplace in there, a fellow by the name of Eddie Tichik. And I spell his last name, I'd just be guessing. But he was a horse trainer. He was Horse Whisperer from Idaho, Arco, Idaho. And I don't know how many horses we had, 16 maybe?
Wow.
So, my recollection in 74 is everything was packed in. on your back. But trail crew might have had a couple horses that might have brought supplies in. I don't clearly recall. But sometime in 74 through 76, I had a bunch of horses brought in, and the backcountry rangers were taught to pack horses, which is not a whole lot different than packing mules.
Mm-hmm.
Mules are more sure-footed. So, 74 was an interesting year. Actually, I was going to mention this, and then probably make Larry laugh if he ever listens to these interviews. So, Larry and I were good friends. And at the time when we met, back in Sterling, Northeastern Junior College, I was dating a gal by the name of Gail, who was my high school sweetheart. Well, come freshman year, she and I went on a different route and dated off and on, but she ended up going to Denver University, I think. But Larry met her, and he was enough of a gentleman after I had broken up with her. I think she probably broke up with me, to be more accurate. He called me up one time and said, "Kurt, would it be okay with you if I dated Gail?"
Hmm.
I said, "Sure. Gail and I are done." So I always thought that was pretty amazing for a fella to ask if it was okay to date with previous girlfriend and make sure they wasn't going to harm your friendship.
Hmm.
So he started dating Gail, and by 1974, they were living together at his ranger station on Mill Creek. I think they might have been married. I'm not sure. Back in the 70s, it didn't always happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, Gail was going to go away. She was going to go back to, I think, the University of Michigan for her master's degree in weaving. And I had to go in the backcountry to Fern Lake. And Larry said, "Well, I'll see if it's okay with his supervisor," who at the time was Darryl Wilson, I think. And I got word from Larry on August 27th, I think it was, in the morning that, you know, I had to stay in backcountry. I couldn't come out for an evening with Larry and Gail before she took off. And this will get a little emotional. So about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I got a call from dispatch. And the message was, "You're to return to the Fern Lake Trailhead immediately." And I thought to myself, Larry's fixed it. So I'm trundling down the trail, happy as a loon.
That's a 4 mile trail.
Yeah. And I get out, I don't know, 6 o'clock at night, something like that. And I walk up, "Hey, what's going on?" I'm happy. And Larry's got this look on his face. I said, "What's wrong?" Said, "Your dad was killed in a plane crash today." I said, "You got to be kidding me." At that time, he was a Learjet instructor.
Oh, God.
And Gail was in the back they're Volkswagen bugs. And she couldn't talk. She was so distraught. The dog had died. So we got in the car, and we drove down to Aurora. And my brother was there, my sister was there, my mom was there. And Larry and Gail were there. And that was the family. I think Rick's former or future wife, Lynn, might have been there too. So we drove from Estes to Aurora. I think the only thing I said was, Learjets don't crash. And Larry had become very good friends with my father. They were both pilots. Larry had flown in United Airlines simulators with my dad.
Wow.
I think Larry was just as upset as I was.
Hmm.
So that was 74, and that's why I knew I was at Fern Lake in the Wild Basin.
Okay.
And interestingly, I'll spare you the details of the crash site, but look outside of Greeley. Well, Greeley was also the place, forget the name of the uniform for Gregory's. Gregory's Uniforms was in Greeley. And I needed a formal park ranger uniform for the funeral. I decided that I would do that. And Larry sent another ranger back up to Fern Lake to get my Stetson. And I went to Greeley and ordered a Class A uniform, which backcountry rangers did not wear.
Wow.
And Larry and I went to that funeral in our Class A's.
Nice.
And all of my dad's friends who were retired military, well, not all of them, but a couple of them.
You bet.
So what's this uniform? I said, it's a National Park Ranger uniform. Oh, well, we've heard of the national parks. That's nice.
Hmm.
And when Dad and I were out doing stuff in the backcountry, Newfoundland and Canada, and all the places we went, we never went to a national park.
Interesting.
But he had come up to Fern Lake Patrol Cabin the week before so that he could go fishing and spend a weekend with his son.
Nice.
So that was my first summer at Fern Lake. Yeah, that's interesting.
If you don't mind me asking, what happened in the crash? How did that...
Well, according to the investigation, the nose trim mechanism got stuck in the down position.
Good, gee.
And the black box recording, you can hear my dad. Saying, give me my ship. Help me pull back.
Wow.
So they went in at a 30-degree angle. And that was 74? Yeah, 74.
Hmm.
So after that, a week or two later, we had another search and rescue operation. And three of us got in a helicopter to go find somebody. And one of the trucker guys was sitting next to me. I don't remember his name. And he noticed that I was squeezing the airframe in front of me. He said, "It's okay. We're not going down." So, it was a pretty traumatic time.
Yes.
Lost my dad. Lost my best friend, and I think it had a great effect on Larry too.
And so, and Gail as well. I mean, it sounded like all three. I mean, Gail would have known your dad and your mom through you to start with. I mean, it sounded like he was an inspiration to a bunch of young people.
Yeah, even back in Spain. Yeah, Gail loved him. Gail was basically, when we dated in sophomore, junior, senior years, she was adopted into the family, even if Kurt wasn't going to date her.
Nice.
Yeah, she was over at the house all the time. And, she had a second mom and a second dad. And a second, I think she was an only child, so my brother Ricky was like her second brother or something.
Nice.
So yeah, she was part of the family, and she was devastated. So I think that after that, I went back to Bear Lake Patrol Cabin. Mom came up for a 4 or 5 day visit. Repaired all the macrame chairs. Those are old pine chairs that have been macrameed. I was told that they'd been part of the Fern Lake Lodge that had not burned. So she re-macrameed all of those.
Wow.
And then in the fall of 74, I went back to school.
For what?
December.
Hmm? Okay, that's right. You were going to graduate in December.
Yeah.
What was your degree in?
College of Forestry, Outdoor Recreation.
Okay.
Which, about 2.5 years into the whole program, I figured out that the Outdoor Recreation Program was in drafting class, and it's like, I wasn't drafting class, it was planning class. Like, okay, you got 5 acres of the city park, and you need to figure out how many swimming pools and basketball courts you can put in and have enough parking for everybody. And I'm thinking to myself, this is the wrong major. But if I'd have changed majors, it would have taken another year to get a degree, so I stayed in it. And actually, one of our classes, can't remember the professor's name, but he had a contract with Beaver Meadows ski area in Colorado to do an environmental impact statement. So that was our class assignment as a senior. We broke into groups, and it was my first exposure to doing environmental impact statements.
And the National Environmental Policy Act had passed in, I think it's 1972, is that right?
Uh-huh.
So this would have been all new ground.
Totally new.
Wow.
And the analysis that we did was so superfluous, as I look back on it, this is ridiculous. It was my first exposure, and there was a a lot of environmental impact statements in the career, so good place to start.
For Beaver, was that right? Beaver Mountain? Was that the Vail? The Beaver Creek folks?
Yeah, Beaver Creek. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah. 74. So now that I think about it, I think that the Wild Basin gig would have been after I was at Burn Lake.
Okay.
And I was there for 2 years. 2 summers. And, so... And also during that time, I think it might have been 74, 75, someplace in there. I got hired as a winter seasonal for about 3 weeks to be a ski patrol ranger in Wild Basin.
Hmm.
And the reason it was 3 weeks is because after I started, and fixed up cabin 16, which is not much larger than a woodshed. And at that time, skied 2 miles in because of the snow. They didn't plow the road all the way into Wild Basin. And Larry called me in and said, you're going to meet with George Wagner, district ranger. Okay, why? Well, we don't have any money for this position. And that was George, and he said, I really want to thank you for taking the job, but we've looked at the budget, and we don't have any money for a winter patrol ranger. And he said, okay, that's fine. I'll volunteer. What? So I volunteered for the winter of 74 as a backcountry patrol ranger on cross-country skis. And
as a volunteer, would the Park Service provide you with per diem some sort of food, or did you have to provide kind of your food yourself?
We'd have to look at the records. My recollection is you got per diem.
Okay.
I think it was $10 a day. Something like that.
Did you have a sense that in the sort of, if you cook for me, I'll cook for you kind of thing, that this would turn in some dividends down the road? Or were you just saying, I love this so much, this is what I want to do? And
obviously I'm going to take the high road on this.
Or both roads.
No, I knew at that time that I wanted to work for the Park Service.
Okay.
And at the same time, all I knew was, I love what I'm doing. I got this little cabin. I get to go skiing. And, it just came naturally.
Can you tell me a little bit more about George Wagner? Was he tall? Was he short? Was he heavy set? Was he skinny? What do you remember about him?
He was a tall man, broad in the shoulders, narrow at the hip. Bushy mustache, soft spoken. We went on patrol one time. It must have been around 76 because we were riding horses and we were packing a horse that had a jackhammer in it, loaded on it. And we rode up to a place where one of the backcountry campgrounds needed an outhouse. And there wasn't any place to dig a hole because everything was rock. So we dug a hole in the rock with a jackhammer for the outhouse. Now, how that outhouse was expected to drain, I'm not real sure. But we finished that job and rode back out, and then there was another rescue, which I wanted to respond to immediately, and George's attitude was, nope. We're up here. Everybody else can take care of the rescue. Well, we got an outhouse put in. So we finished the job, and the rescue was still going on when we got out. By the time we got to the rescue site, it was probably 10 o'clock at night. And all we did was support the activities that was going on. George... one time we were walking down the street of Estes Park, and we're all walking down in our ranger uniforms with our Stetsons on, and I forgot to tell you about my haircut. I'll get to that in a minute. We're walking down the street, and there's this fella with some long hair leaning against the wall, and says to George, I can get one of them hats. Can I be a ranger too? Which I think was a popular song at the time, something about cowboys and their outfits. And George just sort of looked at him and said, son, you're not man enough to wear this hat. So I have a file, my Uncle George file. He could not get used to women being in a ranger uniform, and he was. He was the type of fella that if you disagreed with him, he would take you to task.
How old was he in 1974?
I'd just be guessing.
Yeah.
I was 24, so he was probably, I don't know, 40.
Okay, so he would have been born in 34-ish. He wouldn't have served in World War II, but almost. And he would have seen the revolution of the 60s and 70s as something very strange.
Yeah, and... I don't recall exactly when he was in Stehekin, but it was an isolated community, and he was probably third generation Park Service.
Okay.
Which is one of the things that I've always been amazed about. I was trained by third and fourth generation Park Service people. And when you think about it, the Park Service started in 1916.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to the
the outfit in 1972, 70, 20th, 50 years. So second and third generation folks, and then fourth generation, Larry, are the ones that trained me. The second and third generation people were, as George once said in the memo, where were all of you Johnny Come Lately's when we were fighting the good fight? We had to use our brains instead of our testosterone to make any advances.
What would have made George think that the fight was over?
Oh, I don't think he thought that the fight was over. I think that he thought that the fight was being fought
differently.
Your testosterone rather than your brain.
Okay. Okay. I'm curious now, in 2020, using what you know now, looking back at George then, do you have a sense of where he was coming from?
I think that George was totally committed to the Park Service ideals as he knew them.
Yeah.
And the interpretation of the ideals changes every generation.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting. I just think there's a lot of dedicated employees today still working for the Park Service, and yet there's probably no one leaning against a wall that would say to a park ranger walking by in Class A, where do I get one of those hats? You know, where do I become a ranger? So it seemed as though, I mean, the whole country was in upheaval then. I don't mean to be defending George, mind you. but I'm just trying to understand where he was coming from. And you being the next generation would not have been as near distraught to see, I think, a woman in a Park Service uniform, or to see anyone with long hair, because that was what you grew up with.
Right. It was the 60s and the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And women were, you know, although when you think about it, there were 16 backcountry rangers in Rocky Mountain National Park. At least in 74, none of them were female.
Interesting.
The females were in park ranger uniforms, and they ran dispatch, and they ran the backcountry permit office. There might have been one or two males working in the backcountry permit office, but by far and away, they were females. And the administrative officer, whose name I don't recall, but Larry Wood, wore a Park Service uniform. It was a skirt.
Right.
So the females in the 50s and 60s weren't allowed to wear slacks or trousers. And that was just the norm. And you know, now that we look back at it, it's like, well, that's a bunch of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't. And, you know, if you look at the airline stewardesses and the time and all the different uniforms that they wore, and you visit the various Park Service historical museums, and you look at the outfits, quote, uniforms that the women were expected to work to wear, it's a throwback.
Very much so. Yeah, those, you see those pictures, it's like, wow, they are airline stewardess dresses.
Mm-hmm. They're airline stewardess hats.
Right, little cap, a little kind of, yes. That's right. So George Wagner would have been the district ranger. He would have had, the sub-districts under him, and there wasn't a single female working in those positions. That would have been his choice.
Yeah, I'm not sure at the backcountry permit office. I would assume that was part of the backcountry sub-district.
Okay.
But, yeah, there were females working it, and there were female dispatchers. But that's what females did then.
Right. Right.
That's okay. But the rangers need to be out on patrol so that they can carry heavy weight. They can ride horses. Although, I think it was probably Dave Essex, who was the chief ranger at the time, started a program. Backcountry rangers would run into backcountry campers, and backcountry campers would tell them, well, the permit people in the office said that it was okay that I did this, and it was okay that I did that. So we were instructed once a week, and there were 16 of us. We would take a backcountry permit person with us on patrol. We were required every 2 weeks, whatever it was, to work in the backcountry permit office so that we could listen to all the bullshit that the visitors were giving them. And it really increased our understanding of what they were putting up with. And we knew that the people in the backcountry permit office were giving these visitors the correct information, and what they were telling us in the field was a bunch of lies. So we would, once a week or so, we would have a patrol where we were supposed to take a backcountry permit person with us. And it just turned out to be one of the best communication devices, because we knew that when somebody fed us a story that didn't make any sense, that all we had to do was read the name of the person that issued the permit, and, well, she was just out here with me 2 weeks ago. That's not true.
Right.
So we'd call on the radio to the backcountry permit office and say, you tell so-and-so this? No, didn't. Okay, ticket.
Right.
Which at the time was ludicrous. It was illegal camping was $25. Dog in the backcountry was $25. Well, I can take my dog in the backcountry and get a ticket and pay $25, still cheaper than putting it in the pound.
Right.
Anyway.
What was Dave's last name? How do you spell that?
Essex, E-S-X-E-X.
Thank you. That was a pretty good call on Dave's part.
Yeah, it was excellent choice. Excellent choice. Yeah, he was a leader. Still is. So those were the Those were the Rocky Mountaineers.
And you had a story about your hair.
Yeah, so assuming that 74 was Fern Lake, 75 and 76. I don't know, someplace in there. Living in the teepee, following what I thought was the old Indian ways. All right. Grew my hair long, and actually it might have been 74 when I got the job at Fern Lake. So I showed up. Yeah, it was 74. I left Takahe and my Volkswagen Bug on a snowy June day. Drove up to park and showed up for work with my hair down. Went to my shoulders at the time. It was probably just quite long. And Larry said, you're going to need to cut your hair. Okay. So I went home, and the gal I was dating at the time cut my hair and went back to work. Larry said, I don't know about this. Let's go see George. Walked in. George is like, why is he here? Okay. Larry says, okay, well, we'll take care of this. I got my hair cut 5 times that day.
Wow.
And it was no longer than what's Campbell's name? The artist.
I'm drawing a blank.
Anyway, so, I got it's the only time I've had my hair cut 5 times in the same day.
I can imagine you might have had, you know, been ready for a shave after that. Sort of the Yul Brynner look.
And Larry was a very patient man. And I'm sure he can tell you a story based on his perspective. But, yeah, so got my hair cut 5 times and was allowed to go to work.
So in the spring of, if I get this right, in the spring of 74, you're volunteering to work for Per Diem. Did that change then? Did you get a seasonal position for the summer of 75?
Yeah, 75 and 76, I think I was at Wild Basin.
Okay. As a seasonal?
Yeah, as a seasonal.
And then what would you volunteer then through the winter?
No, I think in 75, I went back to Takahe. We just sort of hung out. And in the winter of 76, in the fall of 76, I was coming back from a backcountry patrol riding on a horse. And I had applied for a job as a winter seasonal position at Grand Canyon on the South Rim.
Huh.
In law enforcement. And one of the dispatchers at Rocky Mountain was named Judy Kunzel. She had been married to a fellow by the name of Ernie Kunzel, who I don't think I ever met in 72 when I was down there. And she told me that they were looking for winter seasonal positions on the South Rim, so I applied for that. And so I'm riding down the trail. I'm about a quarter mile away from the ranger station, and there comes this fella hiking up the trail, and stopped and said, "How you doing?" He said, "Good. How are you doing?" He said, "I'm doing pretty well. What's up?" He said, "My name's Ernie Kunzel. I'm thinking about hiring you. And I thought I'd come up here and find out who you were." So I dismounted and we had a little conversation. I ended up getting hired as a South Rim Patrol Ranger starting in October. And that began my 3 year, 7, 6, 7, 7, 7, 8, my 3 year career of being a permanent seasonal. So in the summers, so I went down and worked for Ernie, and worked until April.
So I'm, hey Kurt, you know, I'm going to step in here going, we've been talking about an hour and 10 minutes, and I've got a ton of questions about Ernie Kunzel, and I know that we're not going to get very far in the Grand Canyon here. Maybe this is a good place to put up a little period. And I could ask you, is there anything else you want to talk about Rocky Mountain National Park before you tell me all about Ernie Kunzel and Ernie sweeps you away to Grand Canyon?
Well, there's so many things that went on at Rocky Mountain. You know, you fall in love with the Grand Canyon, 72. You go to work for surveying for Forest Service and BLM, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then you're a part of the Rocky Mountain crew, Rocky Mountain boys, who had a great work ethic. You got paid 8 hours a day. We probably worked 16 hours a day. And none of us complained because that's what rangers do. And we had great leadership with Larry and Charlie Logan, Dave Essex, George.
Charlie, what was Charlie's last name?
Charlie Logan, L-O-G-A-N.
Thank you.
Just another part of the Park Service family.
Do you think Larry had a hand in telling Ernie that maybe he wanted to come walk up and take a look at you?
That's possible. maybe not. Larry never said anything about it. Ernie never said anything about it. So, just great people at Rocky Mountain.
Nice.
Here's another tidbit. I'll finish this up. So, talking about women in the Park Service. One of the gals at Rocky was named Lori Cameron. And actually, she was one of the first backcountry rangers. But to paint the picture of how women were treated different then, and maybe still, the rule was that you couldn't have a person of the opposite sex staying in your ranger quarters. Well, Lori happened to stay in some ranger's quarters, male quarters, overnight. And Dave Essex found out about it. And so Lori was going to get fired because she stayed in the quarters. And I found out about it and asked Larry permission to go talk to the chief ranger, Dave Essex. And I said to Dave, so hold on a minute. You're going to fire Lori? Why don't you fire the male ranger?
Ah.
And he looked at me and said, you know, I hadn't thought about that. It's the male ranger that invited her to stay. And Lori ended up not being fired. So women were treated differently. Still are, actually, aren't they? But Dave had enough moxie to say, okay, this isn't right. We're not going to fire either one of them.
And how old was Dave Essex?
Oh, 50.
Okay.
I don't know.
So he...
I just saw him 2 years ago at a memorial service for one of our rangers.
Hmm.
And he still looked 50.
Wow.
I'm not sure how old he was then.
Well,
he was a wise... still is a wise man.
He clearly had a different vision than George Wagner.
Yeah. Yeah, he ended up firing George Wagner. Oh, well. So anyway, that's the Rocky Mountain story.
Okay, well, maybe with that... Yeah, we'll pick this up with Ernie in Grand Canyon. And I guess with that, let's go ahead and wrap up this part two, Grand Canyon Oral History with Kurt Sauer, September 12th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Kurt, thank you so very, very much.
You're welcome.